Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the For All Mankind podcast. We're the officially unofficial podcast for Apple TV's For All Mankind. I'm your host, Aaron, and joining me this week, B. Michael. Say hi to everybody.
Hello, everybody.
B. Michael Kroll is a writer and filmmaker living in Pasadena, California, with several degrees. He's once named one of 40 accountants under 40 to watch, once wrote a sketch comedy show about Blink 182. When not writing or trying to get doomed to film projects off the ground, he spends most of his time goofing off and creating melancholy electronic music. B. Michael, how's it going?
Going well, Aaron. Thank you for the opportunity.
I appreciate you having, I sent out the red flare like early this week when Jim's like, I'm not feeling too well, Mr. Stark. And I had like, you know, it's like I was just like, I reached out a bunch of people. I put a flare out on Twitter, and B. Michael's one of the guys who we've been in touch before. He's one of the guys that answered the bell. So I appreciate it very much. If you want to find out more about Michael, B. Michael and what he's doing, I've got some links in the show notes for you. But we're here to talk about For All Mankind. Since you're new to the podcast, how are you liking this season?
You know, I've heard a lot of bad things about the season when I started doing some research. I knew I was going to be on the show. And I don't know. I sort of see the complaints, but I've really been enjoying the season. I mean, yeah, it's more soap opery, but that's just the nature of what happens when space becomes commercialized. You know, that's the whole point of the season, is that we now have blue collar and white collar workers existing, and you get any number of people in one place in one time, there's going to be soap opera and drama stuff, you know? It's like a workplace, not comedy, but it's a workplace drama now. And I think that's okay.
What do you think about this episode in particular?
I liked this episode. I thought the strongest part of the North Korean subplot, you know, the Philip Marlowe-y kind of detective stuff happened. I really liked that kind of stuff. I'm a sucker for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I've always thought the Margot stuff is kind of like a weak link a little bit, because like, I don't know, she never really grabbed me as a character beyond her being very competent. But like, you know, I was having trouble keeping track of who's who and what, that kind of thing, like what's happening here and who's, you know, trying to see through the sides and whatnot of, you know, the Russians and all that kind of thing. But no, overall, I thought it was a very good episode. A lot of chess pieces moving into place to get the next one.
Yeah, and as I predicted, or as I've been saying, that like, even though I haven't liked elements, like I think some of the plots are kind of outlandish, some of the characters weren't my favorite, I said, you know, it's a lot of times shows have a way of taking stuff that maybe was a little rough, maybe was a little half-baked, and when you go into the finale, it's not required to 100% follow the footsteps from A to B on the plots. Just like you've got, you know, Miles, he's the, you know, black market king, and the North Koreans have got their little spy thing going, and like, even though the pieces, individual pieces of the quilt might not have been stitched correctly, the quilt's coming together nice. And I feel like this episode is a very good example of the quilt coming together rather nicely. This, you mentioned Philip Marlowe. This gave me a lot of like techno thriller vibes, you know, like Tom Clancy, where, you know, the audience has all the information, not all the factions do. They're making assumptions based on limited information, that no one accounts for, like random chance and happenstance and bad luck, and that stuff compounds. And I got really caught up in it. And to the extent, like, this has been the case for every damn season of For All Mankind. Mm-hmm. I go into, at the end of the penultimate episode, I'm like, how in the hell are they going to wrap this up in a single episode? And they've never failed yet. So we might be in for like an hour. I haven't looked at the runtime of the final episode. It might be another one of those hour and a half specials. But
it's an hour 16 minutes.
There you go. So we got a supersized episode. It's about 30 minutes longer than they've been averaging this season. But even still, it's like, golly, putting away all of the threads that they've currently got open and unstitched. And in the inimitable way they have of like casting the ball another 10 years into the future. Mm-hmm. I can't see how they're going to do it, but I'm excited to see how it does all come together.
They definitely left some things they got to deal with, you know, like, I don't know if we want to get into stuff immediately, but like, you know, Lee Is that did he murder his supervisor at the end? You know, like was that? I was trying to figure that out this morning. I was watching the episode again. Like, is that just a sleeper hold? Is he dead? What are they gonna do? That's a major
yeah,
issue.
That it's always a tough because like I never know if Hollywood under you know like in Hollywood like you throw a choke on someone for 10 seconds they're dead, right?
Yeah.
But like a lot of times when they do that, they'll throw in the celery stick snapping to let you know
yeah.
that oh his neck's broke, but. Because, yeah, you put someone in sleep roll for 10 seconds, they're going to wake up 5-10 seconds later, pissed off.
Yes, angrier.
Yeah, this guy seems like he's maybe down for the count. I think that's the implication. But, yeah, right. he just murdered a fellow North Korean national.
That's someone's going to miss that. You know, they're going to miss him.
But also, it's like if you commit a big – that's the other theme is if you commit a big enough crime – you know, all the sub crimes don't really matter. Like if you overthrow a government, no one cares that it's illegal. It's just you overthrow the government and you get the, you know, if you steal an asteroid worth $20 trillion, and Earth can't do anything about it. I guess there's the minor drama of what happens to Lee's wife, you know, cause she's still in danger. She's on Earth. He's on Mars. Yeah.
I was just going to say, Aaron, that, it only matters if you're successful. Or it doesn't matter
right.
if you're successful. You have to.
Right.
You shoot at the king. You can't miss.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And in space, not missing can look like a lot of different things. It could be Goldilocks skipping out of solar system. It could be Goldilocks smacking into Earth or Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. Like I've kind of lost sight of that in the last few weeks and over the break. But the whole giant impact theory of what
right.
if they're playing this game of cosmic pool. What if they scratch the cue ball, you know, like and no one's really been. So it makes me think that I'm crazy because no one once in this season has mentioned that as a potential stake. You know, it's all about the
yeah.
economic benefits and all that kind of stuff. So it's like, I don't think it's on the show's radar, but I can't help but think when you're moving asteroids around and trying to insert them into orbits where people are living on those planets. Hoo boy.
Yeah, no, I thought about that, too, because like they're trying to get the asteroid to permanently orbit Mars. Well, because you guys mentioned this last episode, like who's doing all the calculations on the Mars end, right? In theory, all the math has to be done on Earth because of the supercomputers, all that kind of thing. Who's doing it on their end at Mars? And if they screw up, what happens if they do like hit Happy Valley, for instance? You know, something completely calamitous and dramatic like that.
Yeah, and even if Dev has been able with the slide rules and pocket calculators on Mars, able to calculate the correct trans-Martian injection burn. What happens if Earth, desperate to regain control, you know, they need to burn, what, 2 extra minutes? What happens if NASA cuts that at 45 seconds? And now, you know, and everybody's just like, you know, or even the people on board the Ranger, like, start pulling fuel pipes and whatnot. Like, there's a lot of room for things to go wrong.
The one thing I will say is that this show has kind of tracked what you'd consider like the natural evolution of space, you know, first went to the moon, then went to Mars. So the next big frontier is asteroid mining. So if they were to slam the asteroid into Happy Valley, for instance, you know, what would they do next? They wouldn't try to do that again. You know what I mean? So what's the next season going to be? Because the show's coming out for next season, obviously. So what would be the next frontier?
It's a good question because it does look like we're poised to essentially be doing Expanse, the prequel, by next season, you know, like we'll have belters, we'll have people working and living in zero gravity all the time. It's exciting. But that's the other thing is like Jim and I have mentioned several times, like we're not sure whether the theory of this show is going to be we're putting us on the path towards like Star Trek, where it's more utopian and, you know, high minded, or if we're going to go down the path of the Expanse, where essentially we keep the same political, economic things on Earth going in space. And, you know, you continue these cycles of exploitation and domination and whatnot. And I don't know, because like I feel like the way it's going. Like this episode, you have guys like Marv wringing his hands about like, oh, we got 6 billion people ready to be uplifted and a handful of malcontents are bringing it down. But that's human history, man. That's not Star Trek. That's not what something Picard would say.
Well, Star Trek has always been aspirational. I think that realistically, we're probably looking at something like The Expanse. That's kind of the themes they've been playing with all season, you know, like blue collar versus the astronauts, you know, the whole like, you know, yeah, you know what I'm saying. So.
Oh yeah, well, Wallas versus the Belt of Lotus. Yeah, and the thing is that the wild card is Ron Moore, the former showrunner, the guy who kind of architected the show. He's an old Star Trek guy, so what, you know, what was he trying to do? Is he trying to suggest that if we keep working together in space, that we'll figure things out faster? Or but that's the other thing is, like, you know, in Star Trek's fictional history, they didn't go from like us to Star Trek. They went from us to eugenics wars, to World War III.
It was messy.
Yeah, they really fucked things up before things got better. So we'll see. All
Well, that's a
right,
happy
should
note to
we?
start on.
Yeah, well, you know, that's for all mankind. Are we ready to get into the episode?
Let's do it.
You're listening to Hi Bob. We'll be right back.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hi, Bob. Welcome back to More for All Mankind. All right, Brazil is this episode's name, and we join. It's been about a month, Dev says, and their operative Sam on board the Ranger hasn't managed to install Dev and Ed's Rogue Discriminator module. Mm-hmm. And they're beginning to sweat until Sam manages to make her move with just 48 hours to spare.
Yeah, I was a little, I sort of liked how they did this, but like, she's been on the Ranger a month. This is an opportunity she has to dump some water into the vent. You know what I mean? Rang a little false on that one.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like when she finally, then making it out to be like, if this was just resumption from last episode where she's like, oh God, I'm looking for my spot. Okay, I'll squirt this bottle of water in there. It would have played better. But the month, it's like, but I think they should. This is another thing where I don't think the writers maybe had as much time to polish this as I would hope, because it seemed like the easy fix would be for them to be like, well, we don't want to short out the mod. Like there's this tension between wanting to short out the discriminator module and replace it and right. leaving NASA, Russia, Earth the least amount of time to discover the plot and fix it.
Well, that begs the question though, like if they're gonna discover how they're gonna discover it, right? And why would they discover like 48 hours later? Or, you know what I mean? Like, is it okay to have 2 days as opposed to a month? You know, if their plot is that foolproof, they shouldn't be able to tell there's the new discriminator on board. You know what I mean?
But that's the thing, is like, I think they should have made it as like, this isn't foolproof. Like, if people, like, I guess, because they're also making it clear that like NASA's just obsessively testing. They're doing like tests every mm-hmm. system tests every 6 hours and whatnot. And it's like, it's not beyond the realm of imagination to just like, hey, there's something weird in the signal that we're getting back from Ranger. And but the thing is none of that is on the screen or on the page. So. No. You know, we're just kind of supplying a little bit of more believability, because it's like you're left to like for 30 days, Sam's up there mopping the sweat from her brow on how she's going to get the angle and squeezing that to a little bottle. I finally got enough flop sweat that I can short. But because, yeah, it seems like it'd have been pretty easy just to bop up there and squirt some fluid into it.
Yeah, I just assumed it was water. But if now the idea of Samantha throwing flop sweat into the discriminator is really, it's a good one. I like that. It makes me happy.
You know, I've complained about the low G work and the lack thereof this season. I did think they did a pretty good job this episode. They had Sam flying around. I don't know why they don't do a better job at the 1/3 gravity on Mars and whatnot, but like some of this was fairly impressive work. Her kind of skirting around the cabin. But yeah, we also have this the Ranger techs do discover the shorted out discriminator. Sam helpfully offers to go get one out of her private store and swap it. I thought that they do a lot of things to increase the tension this episode. I really like that POV shot of the grate. You know, it doesn't really pay off, but it gives you that feeling that, oh man, we could be watched at any time.
Yeah, I was wondering what they're doing with that, because normally you don't set something like that up and then just drop it.
I think it's supposed to give you into like that paranoid feel, and then it does pay off when you find out later that the North Koreans have wired Happy Valley for sound and audio.
They don't
have the Ranger, but it's kind of like, who could be watching? And with Cho kind of like watching the plotting later, I think it kind of ties it together, and it just increased the
do we know that they don't have the Ranger? How do they get the rest of the rest of the base?
Yeah, you're right. We don't know. I didn't see any feeds of the Ranger, but then again, I wasn't really looking. I was, you know, when he's doing the elevator sleuthing, I was kind of locked in on the elevator. So you're right.
They've kind of already got their hooks into the conspiracy. So that might be putting a hat on a hat, but still,
right?
You know, we don't know. But they could.
After last season, I will never count out North Korea.
No,
because I thought them landing on Mars first was kind of a joke, a meme, but turns out they fucking did it. So, what else? Oh, yeah. So next scene, Kelly briefs Dev on her study of potential life in the Korolev crater, but she noticed he's oddly distracted. What do you think of that?
Yeah, he didn't seem really all that excited about the potential of life on Mars. You know, like, and it wasn't that was the reason why he brought her up there, basically, right? That was, they were supposed to try to find life, try to get evidence of life and right now, and he just didn't seem all that cool about it. I don't know.
It seems like he's using her, you know, like, I think he has genuine affection for her son, because they're playing with their plane models while, you know, he's supposed to be paying attention to Kelly. But it seems obvious that he came to Mars to steal this asteroid, and everything else that he has said to Elaida, to Kelly, I don't even know if he's completely being honest with Ed about, you know, like what happens after this all happens. But the way the episode is structured, we don't know exactly what Ed tells Kelly, you know?
Yeah, I like that part. We'll get to that when we get that scene, but that was actually a really nice touch there.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, we know why Dev isn't really interested in what she has to say, but I don't know. Yeah, he's a hard character to get a read on. I like that about him. He's very, like, you know, what is his true motivations, all that kind of stuff. He's a very deep-thinking character, and it comes out in the performance. But, I don't know. He could have faked a little more excitement about the potential interstellar life, you know?
I think he's the type of guy that has a hard time doing that. And also, like, if he... The way he's, like, cynically using his experience with his father and Kelly's experience with her father and trying to draw that parallel to kind of, and it's not out of any genuine like attempt to, like, you know, connect with Kelly. It's just to kind of soothe her, You know, he's using the shared experience against her. And I think it's like, man, that's really shitty. And I don't know what Kelly does when all the pieces drop here.
I don't know. Like, maybe I'm not really seeing this. Maybe, I mean, I'm seeing him use that experience, but I don't know if necessarily being cynical to manipulate her. Maybe he's
really?
Maybe generally. Yeah, maybe generally you can generally like somebody and still use them. You know what
oh,
I mean?
Yeah, like, I guess what yeah. I'm saying is like my thought is when Kelly is basically saying, what's up with you and Dad? And he's like, oh, you know, it's and she's like, yeah, I wish I was getting closer to my father. And him, you know, seeing an opening in there to like put her a little at ease. But yeah, maybe I'm being too cynical.
Yeah, you're being a cynical Gen Xer guy.
Well, that's how I never get hurt again. You all right? I got my guard up all the time.
Yeah, I'm there too, so don't worry about it.
Ed and Miles lean on the North Korean cosmonaut, first man on Mars, Lee, to yeah. give them to lend them their North Korean spy eyes because they want to see the whole base.
Yeah, I would kind of bumped in this a little bit. I mean, I like this plot line. I like the through line of the North Korean episodes. I'm not complaining too much about it, but like, you know, the whole premise of this is they have these not premise, but one of the ideas they're playing with this season is that we have these guys, these blue collar workers that make life on Mars really possible. So wouldn't they have access to everything already? You know, if they're trying to get surveillance in the ops center to do various other places. Wouldn't they have access to that? I guess there's only like what 4 or 5 people in the conspiracy around it anyways. I guess
they don't have their audio video guy that they could talk into like, hey, could you, cause you're right. You think you could do an Ocean's 11 style, just go to wherever the NASA stuff, the network closet and put your clips in there and do, but maybe, and then also it's like, they only have 48 hours. So it's like, if they know North Korea already has a place wired for audio and video, then it's like probably easier to steal that than, but that's the, it turns out to be one of the fatal flaws in their plan.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny because it's not just one fatal flaw. There's like, this is like the best kind of techno thriller. There's like 3 or 4 loose threads that different people are starting to pull at. And it's like, are they going to be able to the pull the threads, you know, in time? Or is it going to be like, you know, like last season when Karen realizes the bomb plot, but it's literally seconds before it's about to explode.
Yeah.
I'm curious.
They got a lot of Rube Goldberg type machinations going on here, and that's why this all started falling apart. But you know, I like that, so yeah.
It is like I still can't keep thinking that this whole plot makes Lee seem stupid. The idea that they're going to sneak his wife in a cargo transport from North Korea, you know, they got to get from North Korea to America, onto the flight out to Mars. It's like I wish that. When they came clean to them about the plan that Ed and Dev and Miles essentially said, look, here's the deal. You help us on this. We'll be the kings of Mars. We can name our demands. Mm-hmm. Like getting your wife up here will be as easy as asking for a dozen eggs, you know?
That's a strong motivation, but I also think that I don't think it's stupid as much as it's hopeful.
Yeah.
You know, like this is his one shot at getting her out, but yeah, you're right. That your suggestion is much stronger. But I don't necessarily know if the way they did it makes him seem stupid. I think he's just hopeful. Like, hey, if I do this, these guys do have power. They are next to the guy, the Helios guy. You know, if we can do this. Because they said in the beginning, like, we have a plan to get her out of North Korea. It's getting up here is more complicated.
Yeah, I just wonder, like, because I always think, you know, if it would be one thing if this is like a North Korean kind of like the blue collar worker, but this is their one of their cosmonauts.
Right.
I feel like he would understand, like, he'd be like, okay. I want to know what your plan is. But I think the reason that they're being a little opaque there is because there is no real that if they
right.
outline any possible plan, it would seem ridiculous. So they're just like, you know, it's a plan, and Lee probably knows about it. But I don't know. This is just me being a negative Nelly. Probably should put it nip that in the bud. So yeah, I guess things seem to be coming together. They got Lee's help. They got spies in the control room, and they confirm that the Discriminator has been replaced and they have control.
Mm-hmm.
I did love that they had the old school modem sound for like
yeah.
the handshake protocol
between
the Ranger and Mars. Like it's just okay. We got our 14.4 modems connected now. We're all good.
That's a good Easter egg for people who used to do AOL and all that kind of stuff and BBSs back in the day. I like
and you
that
know what?
Too. That was fun.
I wouldn't swear that that's actually what happens when they contact like Voyager. You know, they still like every month or so try to make. I wouldn't, but like this is like 2003. I don't know. I guess it is the heyday of the modem handshake there.
What? Wouldn't it suck if next episode someone tries the phone while they're talking to the discriminator and knocks it off? That'd be hilarious.
Mom, I'm trying to steal an asteroid. Get off the phone. Yeah. So Elaida, back on Earth, gives some cloudy financial forecasts to the M7 meeting about how long it's going to take to realize the Goldilocks gains, even with it being in Earth orbit, before Margo pulls her aside and insists on having some risky communication with Sergei.
Yeah, this is, things were kind of going off the rails a little bit for me here in this episode. Like, you know, we'll talk more about this when we get to the dinner scene, but, you know, I find it hard to believe that Sergei is the only person that can do this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, this is a big enough project for both Roscosmos and NASA. You know, this is the project. They have the best minds of the planet doing this, and they need this guy Sergei to help him with figure the stuff out that they do is clandestinely and all that kind of thing with so much risk. That was kind of a little, I bumped a little bit on that. I gotta be honest.
Yeah. I will say that, everything that they said about Margo at the start of the season about how long she's been out of the game and how her technology and her skills are out of date has to go double for Sergei, who's been teaching high school physics for the last like 8 years, you know?
Yeah.
He's had less involvement. You know, he hasn't been like, you know, keeping up with what's going on. So I agree, but I interpret that as like, this is more about Margo wanting to connect with Sergei. She doesn't need him, but she wants to connect to him. And,
well, then why does Elaida go along with it, though?
Yeah.
You know what
that's
I mean?
That's a good question, because Elaida feels obligated towards, but I don't know. You're right. And it's also ludicrously dangerous, the idea that Sergei can meet with at Elaida's house just because he parked three blocks away and cut through a neighbor's yard. I mean, what?
Four blocks.
Like this is teenager logic for sneaking out of your house to go see your girlfriend at 1 a.m, right?
Yeah.
It's cool, babe. It's cool, babe. I parked down the street and I cut through the neighbor's yard. No one, like, this is not what you do when you're trying to outsmart a professional spy organization who got hungry eyes on you.
Yeah, both KGB and America are watching this woman, you know? And like, that's another thing. Like, they just let her go out to dinner and they don't bring anyone inside.
Thought that was some bullshit too, that they don't, like, maybe they, I don't know, I guess he came there hours before, but it's, again, I think this is a little bit of a stretch. But you know what, like, as Elaida says, what part of the plan isn't? So the North Korean station chief back on Happy Valley notices something odd about their spy equipment. His monitors are all staticky, and finds out that there's a piece of NASA gear, labeled NASA gear, on the back of this thing, and he angrily confronts the good Danny about it, demanding her open an investigation immediately.
Okay, I am not completely up on digital video technology, right? I have a TV, it's hooked into my Sonos Arc system, and I love it. It's great. I've kind of labored under the idea that if it's digital, you don't get those kind of like staticky analog looking effects, right? Like, this is all digital. It's being transmitted digitally. It's being beamed out digitally. Why are we getting these static effects on the monitors? All right, what do you think about that? I mean, am I being too nitpicky here?
Is it digital though? Because it looked like, honestly, that NASA gear looked like, going back to our Gen X roots, looks like the signal adapter that you screwed your Nintendo into in the back of the, you know, it has the coax or the bayonet connectors. Like, it didn't look like it's like an HDMI or something. It looked like it's just literally, and like, even today, I don't know. This, my information is like from 10 years ago, but I used to work for a big C-store chain, and even then, when we were like storing the things digitally, like we stopped using VHSs and started using hard drives, a lot of the cameras were still those old BNC type, you know, analog connectors. They would go into these capture cards and you capture them digitally. So like, I guess I could believe that they got a shitty connector on there. I just thought it was hilarious that there's actually a box labeled NASA. that they, yeah. You know, I know they don't have a lot of time. This was like a hasty hack job, but it's just like really funny. The North Korean guy's like, what is this? And there's like a giant NASA logo on it, you know?
Yeah, like walking over there, they could have like just scraped it off or something, you know? I mean, but then again, we're not dealing with actual criminals here. We have people, like smart people that, but again, I'm okay with it because the plot is usually pretty strong. I know we've been sitting here kind of capping on it the whole time and say the plot's strong, but no, I like it. It's strong, but you know, come on, guys. Let's have a little bit of more of a thought process going into this a bit.
The only funnier thing would be if they had like Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes in a spacesuit pissing on the North Korean flag. Like, that's the logo, you know? Like, fuck it. Let's make
sure. That's on the back of their rover.
Tell North Korea I want them to know it was us.
I hope there's a scene, like, if they get caught up, a scene like Dev is like shouting at somebody, like, you didn't think to take the sticker off? Come on, you know?
Yeah. And there's a lot of some comedy. Like, I really like Lee just sweating, like, that his commander finding this almost immediately. I really like how the Lee and his commander, I think his name's Cho.
It's Cho Bun-ho. I checked that out in the credits.
Okay. The way that they're like doing matching mean mugs, like, you know, and they're, you know, demanding investigation, and when they stop talking, he just assumes this, like, this particular expression, and Lee looks at it because Lee's like, you know, he's kind of like a little Americanized, and he's like, oh shit, this is, and he adopts it too. It's just really funny.
Well, he's also got to like keep any suspicion off that he helped with this.
Yes, of course.
You know, so he's got to keep up face.
Yeah. And like, it's also funny that because this is often the case when you read these like spy thrillers is that, you know, like North Korea can't reveal NASA's attempt to spy on them without revealing the fact that, oh, yeah, by the way, we've been spying on you this entire time. It's like, I wonder if Cho had ran this up the chain of command if they would have been like, don't confront them, you idiot. You just now they think we don't know. That they know, how can we use this against them? That's the obvious spy play. But this guy, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what political political kind of appointment he has here. But I don't think he thought it through.
Well, your point's well made. But like, remember that these guys are astronauts first; they're not spies.
True.
You know.
It's interesting because like this guy's ranting and raving in Korean and she picks out him saying Miles Dale and Danny clocks that. And like, I think she was kind of like, yeah, fuck these guys. I don't care. I got an asteroid to capture, but that name really rang her bell. And that kind of, it's like, no, one of those little kind of odd happenstances. She happened to catch that name and that's like suddenly, okay, you technician, take this part, run it down. Like, it instantly add a little fire under the investigation.
I like Danny's character a lot, so it's good to see her kind of like, you know, stretching out a little bit here. I like that.
And they're also informing, this is the first time I think that they're informing us that, because that Danny and Lee have a little bit of a conversation. It's the first time the show's telling us that essentially after Goldilocks is captured, Danny's planning to be wheels up and back on Earth. Because she says we'll be Earthside before you know it.
All right, are we getting to the next scene? Because I have some thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Danny V-mails her son about how proud she is of him and how she can't wait to return to Earth after Goldilocks is done to be the best damn grandma in the solar system.
First of all, point A, I love how she's going to introduce the next generation to MASH. I love that. MASH is a great show and everyone should watch it. B, she's dead. She's a dead woman walking because you don't send a message out to your son.
I have it bold. Is this a scene of doom? Because, damn it. This is the cop saying he's 2 weeks from retirement.
Yep. You don't start making plans with your kids like this and then, like, you know, walk out unscathed.
I will say that the only hope I have, because honestly, good Danny dying, I kind of got like a little weepy in this scene because she is a beautiful character and these are beautiful sentiments to express. But, the only sliver of hope I've got is like, I thought they were really coding Ed to die last season. And he, you know, pulled out this miraculous recovery, got Kelly to orbit, managed to just thread the engines just right to avoid death. I hope they pull out that for Danny because, like, man, I just don't really. It'd be a huge blow. It'd be a huge blow to see Danielle die.
she doesn't seem like she's a tragic character, you know? Like, Ed kind of feels like a tragic character a little bit. Danny doesn't. You know, she's hyper competent. She knows what she's doing. She's been great in the show. I don't know. Maybe, I was hoping I was watching this thing. I was thinking, like, you know, the asteroid slamming into Happy Valley. And last thing we see is, like, Danny there and all sorts of flames going up around her. And
it would suck if Ed survives, because here's the thing. Like, Ed reveals in this episode that, like, his greatest fear is probably Danny's dream, which is to die of old age surrounded by your grandchildren and your children. Ed wants to go out in a blaze of glory. Danny just wants to do her job and get home to her loved ones. And,
you know, it's interesting. All the parallels they've been doing to this episode, that is an interesting parallel I hadn't considered. Yeah, like, his nightmare is her dream, like you said. That's a good one. So, yeah, Danny's dead. Ed survives. That's it. That's put $5 down for me. That's what happens.
I have to talk about the Star Trek angle here.
Yes.
Because Danielle says that, I know you hate it, but I'm going to do my damnedest to turn my granddaughter into a huge Trekkie. And she says, I'm going to start her with the series, all three of them.
Yeah, now, I know. I thought you might pick up on that.
1995 is when Voyager premiered. Are they saying that Voyager, like, they just have the old series, TNG and Deep Space Nine, and is this the better timeline where Voyager never existed?
All right. I'm not a Trekkier, but I will say this in defense of Voyager. It has the best theme song of any of the Treks ever.
So, cut it, Talitha. I got a bad host here with bad opinions.
I said theme song. It's a great theme song. The original one's pretty great too.
I was going to say the old series and TNG better than that. That's
okay.
Deep
TNG,
Space Nine.
No.
Eh.
No. Okay. TNG. Okay. Can we agree on one thing, Aaron? The Enterprise theme sucked. What?
Okay. Yes. What the hell? Rod Stewart singing Star Trek. What are they thinking?
That was. I stopped watching that show just because of the music, honestly.
I think that's the first Trek that I didn't make it through a whole season. I made it through two seasons of Voyager before I'm like, yeah, I've graduated high school now and I'm doing other things. But like Enterprise, I think I made it through two episodes. I'm like, what is this? And again, I don't mean to offend anyone that likes Voyager, and that's part of being a Trekker. Is busting each other's balls. So if Voyager and Enterprise are your favorite, you're wrong, but you know, I still love you.
I'm more of a Star Wars guy, so Voyager fans can just bite it, I guess.
Now we're going intra-family disputes. It could get a little dicey when you go there, but you know, I'll make sure I post B. Michael's socials. You can get at him.
It was really nice meeting everybody. I gotta go. Bye.
So, Alayda invites Sergey and Margo to a little covert collaboration over dinner at her house. Again, this is the horny teenager plot of don't worry, babe, I snuck out and it's fine. It's funny because, like, this is the thing that they've been kind of hinting at. I think I forgot to mention this when Marv ducks out of Alayda's meeting.
Right.
It's clear to everyone except for maybe Alayda that stealing the Earth, effectively stealing the asteroid from Mars, is going to end the Mars program. And they really lay it out bold here.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought it was an interesting revelation that I think they're hinting that Margo gave Sergey the plans to the fusion drive just so that Mars would be a competition, because they both knew that if the United States pulled out a significant lead and Russia couldn't keep up, the United States would get bored and stop.
Yeah, and that's kind of what parallels what happened in real life. I mean, we haven't gone back to the moon because there's nothing there.
And you know, we're only going back now because China's trying, some would say.
Yeah, I think it's a good point they make, and it is kind of a shame you're into space, but like, I don't know. Like, I didn't necessarily have an issue with that, one thing I was taking from this scene is like, just kind of like the machinations of this conspiracy. Who's doing what? How are we doing these calculations? How are we making all this math happen? You know, because we got these guys on the dinner table and their little hand-drawn notes and whatnot. And I buy that, you know, you kind of do your own notes, but again, going back to my earlier point, this guy, how is he singularly so brilliant that he's essential to this plan? That they would risk everything to bring him here to go to dinner and talk about this stuff to do what? That's to figure something else out other people can't figure out, but the smartest people in the space program? I don't know. And you're right. It's a horny teenager thing. It doesn't make a lot of sense. You start pulling
that's
on threads.
That's the only way. That's the only angle it makes sense. Like, it doesn't make, like, he is not vital to the translunar injection orbits. He's vital to getting Margot's lady parts rumbling for the first time in a decade. You know, like, he's going to hit her with the Duke Ellington. He's going to hit her with the Big Mac. She's going to be thinking about. And it's the other thing that's like a little cynical is that Sergei, I think, is just going to leave his wife. Like, your fake is Margot. His wife? You're fake Margot in Iowa, and you're okay when I didn't have real Margot, but, you know, brand name Margot's back, and it's the great value Margot is going to be left. We're going to go to Brazil, okay? It's kind of shitty.
It is. It's really shitty. It really is shitty. And, like, you know, they established the time as a month. Like, Sergei just up and left Iowa, as in Iowa, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I got an email about that.
Yeah, I got up and left Iowa and this. Where is his wife? I mean, I understand you can't do everything on a show. You only have 10 episodes, but like.
Yeah.
I just get this pressure, like, you know, like, oh, okay, see you later, you know, and she does nothing.
Walked out of his high school job, went left instead of right, and then that's the last time. He's a missing person. You know, she's weeping in her Iowan home, wondering what the hell happened to her dashing Russian husband. It's. Yeah. I don't know why they. Why did they give him a wife? I would have much rather I would have feel microscopically better about this if we just never saw his wife. Why? Yeah, like, he's just been pining for Margot this entire time, as the love of his life, the only person he was simpatico with, his peer and equal, and he just never found another one. But turns out he was slumming with shitty Margot, and now he's going to break someone's heart.
Why don't we call her shitty Margot? I'm sure she's a lovely person, man.
You're right. You're right.
Let's not.
I'm just saying. Right. I mean, like, if he left her after seeing one press release of Margot, she can't be that good. Okay.
Well, horny teenager. That's all we got to say.
That's true. It's horny teenage logic. It's the only thing that makes sense.
I also really love that. Like, they didn't show this episode, but, like, you know, it's such a great visual gag that you turn left, you go into your life. You turn right, you go back to Margot and your fun space life. You know, and
yeah.
You just. Turns right, and that's it. Heads to Houston.
I think it's kind of cute. There's a little bit of thawing between Margot and Elaida as Margot's slipping. She's turning into her inner grandma, and she's slipping the kids' candy that she's got in her pocket. You know, like, those that. Tootsie Rolls are like 6 years old and rock hard, yep. Man. It's going to, like, when those kids bite down that Tootsie Roll, is going to pull at least three teeth out of their skull.
God, that happened to me when I was like a child. I had a piece of candy, like, I had a loose tooth, and, like, you know,
sound like grandma knew what she was doing there. I had the loose tooth and the Jolly Rancher, and there you go.
No, it wasn't grandma. It was my own dumb thing. I was eating candy, and, like, you know, pulls teeth out of your head. That's God, it's terrible to think about. Sorry, audience, bringing that up. That's a horrible image.
I did get excited because I thought this was a cool idea, the fact that they could defect to Brazil, which is a country that is plausibly powerful and wealthy enough to put off Russian and United States interference as they build a space program. I think that's a cool idea, and it's a damn shame we're not. Well, I guess Margot could still do it, but she doesn't have the connections.
Yeah, I like that. I think it's a kind of a hopeful kind of thing going on, because I don't believe one second that they're just going to go to Brazil and be able to be in that public of a job and then not be taken out by either Russia or America, you know?
Yeah.
Like, Sergei's got to know that in the back of his mind somewhere, either of those countries' intelligence operations wants you dead, you're dead. You know, and, like, both these two running off to go help Brazil, that's a black eye. Someone's going to get mad. Someone's going to take you out. I can't believe that Sergei doesn't think about that. And maybe Margot's thinking about that a little bit, because she's actually living under that regime right now. But I don't know. It's a nice dream, and I think that's a good thing. It was kind of cool to talk about, and I was hoping that would be the case, but obviously we see it later, it's not going to be the case.
I would like to, if anyone knows different on feedback, because I think one of the ideas is with the whole Monroe Doctrine, the whole, like, you United States saying, hey, this Western Hemisphere is ours. Nobody fucks with the Americas, right?
Right.
Has there ever been an instance of Russia murdering someone in North, South, or Central America? I'd be curious. Because, like, if this is, like, Europe or Africa or Asia, I would agree. But, like, I don't know. But you've also got two rogue citizens. They're not, like, would America care if someone took Margot out? I know they wouldn't give a shit about Sergei. That was the only reason they did that is because of Margot.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably more Russia than America now that I think about it, but yeah. Still, I mean, it was. I mean, as we saw, Sergei is going to get taken out anyway. So, spoilers. Yeah. Sorry, guys.
It's spoilers for 30 more minutes in the episode. Yeah, but again, I think it's maybe horny teenage logic, you know, like 17. Oh, yeah. Hey, let's run away. Let's get away from this Vegas. Place. And yeah, I got a little bit of money saved from McDonald's, and you've got, yeah, it's.
We can live on love.
Let's cash out our college fund and live off, live off love. So Danny calls up the Wet Bandit here on Earth and briefs him about all the missing communication and computer equipment. He says, hey, don't look at me. It must have been Harry. I don't know. This is just kind of like catching important people up with what the audience already knows, right?
Yeah, exposition dump. Nothing really to go on here.
And then we see a scene of the North Korean commander keeping a watchful eye over the base. He's hunting for Miles, and he notices some elevator shenanigans.
Yeah, I love this scene. This is great. It was well put together. It was like, you know, showing exactly what's going on. I have to admit, though, the first time I saw it, I wasn't sure if he's like watching like old footage. I thought maybe he was going over old surveillance footage to see who got into their section. But when I watched it a second time to start taking notes on this, I saw they're doing this really cool device. I really like this a lot.
It is really cool. And it's like completely nonverbal. You're just watching a guy put things together and like, oh, it's like, and you start to, there's like little bells going off. Like Miles backs out of going into the elevator when someone else steps on, like, oh, that's weird. And he buys some time and then gets on the elevator, rides it. Then the elevator opens up and it's gone. And then he sees the restricted elevator levels and all that stuff. I thought it's a really, really well constructed scene.
No, I like this one a lot. So yeah.
Very rude to his team, man. You know,
yeah.
If he'd been a nicer guy, maybe Lee doesn't choke him out. So yeah, we have another scene where now Marv has gotten his buddy Will and Arena from Russia together to discuss what they're going to do about the stolen equipment.
Yeah, this is all completely logical. You know, more exposition, moving the plot forward. You know, Eli gets those guys together. It's okay, let's activate our intelligence operatives. Let's find out what's going on. You know, they're all figuring out what you said. They're figuring out what the audience knows, and they move forward with their plans up there.
T-minus 3 seconds until the ad. Touchdown, and we're back. So they make a literary reference, and I gotta look those up every time I hear one. They mention Arena shouts out Dostoevsky's. The Crystal Palace. Are you familiar with this reference?
No, I've read some Dostoevsky, but she also says some asshole decides to destroy it. I'd be very surprised if a Dostoevsky uses the word asshole, but it sounds like something he would say, you know?
Yeah, so this is from his Notes from the Underground. Which is, I'm going to quote from a quote from an article that I found. It says it's at least partially a response to Nikolai Chernovsky's novel, What Is to Be Done. In this book, Chernovsky espoused an optimistic confidence in human rationality. He thought that if people could be taught well enough, they would naturally desire what is best for them, and society could continually improve until we reach the utopian existence symbolized by this image of a crystal palace, a perfect building where everyone lives in harmony. The same symbolic building shows up in part one of Notes from the Underground, where an underground man vehemently disagrees with Chernovsky. I'm murdering this guy's name. Chernyevsky. Yeah, that's not even better. Championing the importance of irrationality and free will against the logic and laws of nature. The underground man says that he would hate to live in a crystal palace because he wouldn't be able to stick out his tongue rudely there.
Yeah.
In other words, he wouldn't be free to indulge his spites and irrational desires. The crystal palace thus symbolizes essentially the same thing in Dostoevsky's novel as it had in C's. I'm going to call him C. Chern. His novel. A utopian place of purely irrational living. In Notes from the Underground, though, the utopia is denigrated as an impossible dream and one that wouldn't even be desirable if it were possible. I thought this is the for all mankind thesis, right? Can we build a crystal palace, or will some assholes always tear it down?
Well, I mean, people are tearing stuff down, but we've been moving forward for like four seasons, you know? Things have happened, right. But we've always moved forward. So, yeah, I think it's a thesis, but I think that they're arguing that even if there's trouble, we still move forward and we got to do.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that Dostoevsky gave the underground man a very, like, churlish... You know, it's like it's hard to map it on one-to-one because in this case, the Crystal Palace, the guy's like, you know what? We're working in the basement of the Crystal Palace and we're getting screwed over by the people living on the top floors, and we would like a little bit more of the equality and utopia. Yeah. Instead, it's like yet I feel like the people on Earth already see the Martians as like, oh, they're just wanting to stick their tongue out at us. They're like, they have no legitimate beefs. They're just trying to be an asshole and try to step in the way of 6 billion people's progress. When, you know, you could just as easily turn that around and be like, well, why don't you pay the 500 people on Mars a little bit more money? If it's 6 billion people's livelihoods riding on it, it seems like that's an important job. But they never look. It's always just they're sticking their tongue out at us.
Well, that also brings up an interesting point about Dev's character. Like, what is his motivations here? Because... Ah, damn, I had the thought, I lost it. But, you know what I'm saying? Like he's kind of exploiting the labor, too. Like, he's, you know, he's not going to give them an equal share of the asteroid, right? He's going to give them something. Yeah, exactly. So he's being exploitative, too. But what is his end game beyond the... Because he said he doesn't want to leave Mars ever, so I guess it's the asteroid who puts in orbit and he exploits that. But, like, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, some of these guys like him want, like, they see human advancement as, you know, and it's a worthy goal unto itself, but like, you also can't, like, humanity is made up of individuals, and if there's individuals being left out of that advancement, of course they're going to want to tear down the Crystal Palace, because why the fuck do you get to live in a Crystal Palace when I'm living in a hovel, you know? So anyway, yeah, life is hard. Economics and politics, complicated. Will we ever be able to get off this rock as brothers and sisters? I don't know. We'll see what For All Mankind has to say. So Danny meets her spies, because that's at the end of that scene. Marv agrees to activate the KGB and CIA assets, which are two guys. And Danny expresses surprise at them both, but they are committed to finding out what's going on here in the base.
Yeah, I have to admit, I didn't recognize either of those two guys. I had to go back and make sure they were in the show prior to this. But yeah,
were they?
But
did you look in IMDb? Because like, I bet they were. Like, and in fact, I think the KGB guy might have said something in one of those break room debates that we saw. But I didn't recognize the CIA guy at all.
Oh, I just had an earthquake out here. That's crazy. Sorry, interrupt. Sorry.
Whoa! Did you just have one too, Talitha? I think I just saw Talitha's screen. What the fuck? Live earthquake. I'm from the Midwest, where our weather's shit and we got tornadoes, but earthquakes, not really a thing. So that was cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, if you see me jump up and run, there's an aftershock. Just letting you know.
Yeah, head for what are you supposed to be, under tables or in doorways? I forget what the...
door frames.
We only know how to survive tornadoes.
You know, I'd rather have an earthquake than a tornado, honestly, but, you know.
So before the earth quaked, what were we saying?
I honestly, I completely forgot. Can we roll back to tape?
This is a good fucking podcast. We made the earth move, baby. Yeah.
I gotta that doesn't happen back. When Jim's your co-host.
That's true. You might have some questionable Star Trek opinions, but you know what? You got us there. So thanks, B.
you're quite welcome. Okay. So, the guys, we're trying to figure out if these guys ever appeared again. And yeah, I checked the internet database. The Mike character was in two episodes prior this season, so they did establish him. I'd be really curious to see actually what he does, because I don't recall him at all. The Russian guy, I think maybe you're right. I think he showed up in the meeting with Dev. I think he might have been visible in that one, but yeah, I didn't really recall either of these two characters at all.
I thought it was funny how, you know, she's like, oh, KGB and CIA working together, huh? And they're like, well, you know, it's like the Apollo Soyuz kind of, you know, we're ready to be put our differences aside for the sake of patriotism.
Kind of makes you happy, doesn't it? It's just a tear to your eye.
It really does. It really does. And then the Miles connection gets made. She puts him on the Miles Davis, which kind of their eyes click. And that's bad news for Miles, turns out. And it's interesting that, like, you know, here's Spycraft in a nutshell. Like, this KGB spy knows there's a black market. He knows who's running it. He knows all this information, but they're not going to say anything because then they'd reveal that they know, right? It's like, we're just going to keep this in our back pocket.
Yeah, use it, keep it till you need it.
So Kelly goes to her father Ed's quarters to find out where he's at, and she's kind of going over his pictures. She sees a picture of Kelly and Ed holding her over Christmas as a baby. When Ed comes in, and she demands to know, why are you lying to me? Ed is a little forthcoming.
Yeah, like he gets more forthcoming in a subsequent scene. I thought it was kind of interesting that they cut it in the middle to put this stuff with the next scene with the Commander Ho.
Yeah, it's the bane of Jim's existence when they start slicing the plot fine for pacing issues. Because yeah, you're right. The meat of this happens next scene. The North Korean commander examines the elevator and he sees some telltale scratches on the control panel. Implying some method of illegal access. At the same time, Miles heads to his next job among intense security. They really got this base locked down, and he finds a KGB and CIA waiting for him.
They call him up to do like some kind of business, and then they basically interrogate him.
We got a big problem, but it's not with their HVAC.
Yeah, they do have a big problem. I know, like, it's kind of like these three scenes are kind of set up a lot of stuff for the next act. But, like, you know, I love, like I said before, I love the Philip Marlowe stuff with, like, you know, he's investigating the elevator, he sees some scratches, and then he goes down. I love that part. You know, the North Korea stuff I think is great this episode. Miles being snatched by the intelligence agents, I mean, that was always going to happen. And then that gets paid off after this scene 18 with Ed and Kelly talking about Ed's motivations.
Yeah, and let's get back to Ed. So Ed kind of opens up to Kelly about his hopes and fears and his dreams for the future. I love it because at the end she's like, well, that's great, but what the fuck are you doing? Like, you know, as I was watching the scene, I kind of fell under its spell. I'm like, wow, he's really opening up and they're sharing this emotional. And after they kind of dry their eyes and she hugs him, she's like, okay, now what's really going on? And he's like, fuck. I haven't told. I've been this vulnerable. I haven't even said nothing. I thought that was great.
No, I love the scene too, and like just for all reasons you're talking about, because it adds another dimension to Ed's character. I mean, he's that, you know, starts off in season one as like the Top Gun kind of like space guy, and he's like the masculine. He's like really tall, broad shoulders, and you know, Ed Baldwin. I mean, that sounds like a hero's name, doesn't it? Ed Baldwin, right? It's got that kind of like
very strong.
Yeah, very strong name. And then he just opens up to his kids. Says, look, I'm afraid of dying, and not only am I afraid of dying, the way I'm probably going to die if I get off this base is like everyone else, just eventually disintegrating and degenerating until I'm just nothing. I can't do that. And so he wants to stay on Mars, and then and you're right, and she's like, okay, that's great, what are you doing up here? And then he kind of gets a little bit of a look and they cut right there. Then I love that button. That was a great scene.
It's funny because from Ed's perspective, you know, all the people that he looked up to, admired, or competed with, you think of Zeke, you think of Molly, you think of, I mean, they mentioned Gordo, they all have already gone out in their blazes of glory.
Right.
And the only one that's kind of left from the old guard is him and Danielle. And my position is, I don't think he's ever truly respected Danielle. He likes her. He thinks she's a good astronaut, but he doesn't respect her as like a pilot, as a risk taker, as a leader. So all the people that he's kind of measured up to are all dead and gone, and they are like in Valhalla. They all died with their boots on, and now he's got the shakes, and he's like really worried that he'll, like, you know, Gordo's old man, who is this grizzled Marine, not afraid of anything, and he ends up dying alone in a nursing home, shit in his pants. Like, that is, I mean, honestly, that's terrifying. I don't think you have to be... I only got to be a hard-charging astronaut to be terrified of that fate. That's something that I've been, you know, as I'm getting older, thinking a little bit more of, like, Jesus, that's, oof, how do you avoid that kind of thing? But
yeah, I have a couple of friends with their parents dealing with dementia and whatnot, and, you know, we're both of that age where that's these kind of things start happening to our parents, and you look at that, you're like, wow, I don't want that to happen to me at all, right? You know, your mind is literally going, you don't know anything, you don't remember people, you know, get all sorts of horrible like emotional problems happening at that. That sounds like a fate worse than death. So yeah, as a person who's getting older, I really appreciate Ed's point of view on this. I don't know if it would cause me to go up to stay and want to stay on Mars because I'm afraid of flying, and B, that would suck to not have like live off Earth. But you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what I was trying to say there. But basically, yeah, I get it. And I think I buy his motivation. I love that he's talking to Kelly about it and being open about it. And again, I love that they just cut it right when she asked him directly what he's doing. And I don't know. What do you think? Did he tell her?
Does Ed Baldwin level with his daughter about the theft of a $10 trillion asteroid in a moment of emotional vulnerability? Yeah, I'm going to say no. But they definitely got me like with his emotionality and the look at his face and how he's like, shit, I can't get out of this. I'm either going to have to double down and tell the big lie, or I'm going to have to come clean, and then who knows what's going to happen. Boy, they engineer so well that it's very like 50-50, but I kind of think that no, he probably didn't.
See, I think that he did for the reason you're talking about. He seems like he's vulnerable and he's trying to be a stand-up guy to his daughter, and she asks him directly. I don't know. I think he tells her, maybe not all the aspects of it, but I'm trying to tell her, yeah, Dev and I are trying to secure the future of the Mars base by handling the asteroid. You know, I think he tries to self, I think he spins it self-servingly like that, but I think he tells her.
I wasn't going to do this, but like, it feels like we got served up. We're talking about our friends getting older and whatnot, but, cause it's funny. Cause my granddad had Alzheimer's, and it was a rough situation. Yeah. And my sister and I have been talking the past year about how we're getting concerned for our father. And my father just last week asked me if I would order him some memory supplements off of Amazon. I'm like, oh Jesus. And, it's a shit, you know, Alzheimer's and other memory cognitive, diseases are terrible. And we are just a month out from our annual Groundhog Day marathon. Jim and I started about 7 years ago, I think. We watched the movie Groundhog Day on Groundhog Day for 24 hours to raise money. And we've been doing it for the Cure Owls Foundation, the Cure Owls Fund, cureowls.org, for the last, I think, 4 years. And this year on Groundhog Day, starting on noon on Groundhog Day, we're going to watch all of the Spider-Man films. All of the Maguires, all of the Hollands, all of the Garfields, and the 2 Miles Morales for 24 hours to raise money for Cure Owls. We're going to have some people joining us. It's going to be a great time. In fact, B. Michael, if you want to stop by at some point and say hi, we would accept that. It happens on twitch.tv/baldmove. Again, February 2nd, Groundhog Day. If you have some family or friends that have been touched by Alzheimer's and you want to support a charity where 100% of your donations goes to support the cure, check it out. Now, this has got the old last year's information, groundhog.baldmove.com, but we will be updating. We probably already updated it, but Jim's been sick. It will be updated probably within the next week with all the new information, the exact movie schedule and all that stuff, a link to where you can donate. But yeah, we raised just under 25 grand last year. We're going to try to break the record this year. So yeah, I just want to take time out. We're a month out and do a little bit of charity promo here. Groundhog.baldmove.com. So I was surprised to see how tall Miles stood under the interrogation, of these guys. Like, they're asking some pointed questions, and I think he's got some pretty good answers until the fists come out.
That's true, how it goes. You know, everyone's got a plan to get hit in the face. You know, that's what
that great Mike Tyson quote. Yep.
Was that Mike Tyson or Muhammad Ali? That's Mike Tyson.
I thought it was Mike Tyson said, yeah, everybody's got a plan until you get hit punched in the mouth.
Yeah, Ali said a lot of greater things. Well, we'll go with this one to Tyson. But yeah, he was, you know, until they put the pressure on, he's pretty cool character. You know, cool and Luke kind of guy. And
it does make sense, right? Like, he's saying to them the same thing he said to Ed and Dev when they came to him. Like, look, I do foot cream. I do mouthwash. I do things to make, you know, it's like, yeah, I get it's illegal, but I'm just trying to help people out. And why would I risk that for why would I steal all this equipment? And, you know, he thinks he's dealing with the cops and he's dealing with the spooks from the CIA and the KGB. And turns out they'll just beat your ass.
Yeah, I was going to say, watching this, I'm like, if I get caught by the CIA, I don't know, I didn't do anything with the CIA, would be interested in me. But, like, you know, if the intelligence operatives ever get my hands on me, I am rolling immediately. I do not care because they will mess you up. And
I'm not waiting for them to get the sodium pentothal out and the tools or be rendered extraordinarily rendered to fucking Egypt so they can string. Yeah, no. Yeah, it's just, yeah, I'm not. Yeah. Especially when you'd have to hold out for 48 hours. Maybe if it's 15 minutes, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's just long enough to, but I don't know, even 15 minutes might piss them off. So, like, no, I'm just going to spill my guts immediately. We're going to CIA. All right, what do you want to know? I got notes. I have recordings. Yeah. What do you got? What do you want?
And I love how the official narrative has already gone from these guys were striking workers and the scabs that were trying to union bust got themselves set on fire to now they're terrorists. And you burnt my friend into his spacesuit and you, and it's a pretty ugly business.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting switch. That probably was intentional to kind of put him off guard, because if he's being, like, you know, wrestled for his black market stuff, I mean, you change tactics, you can get rid of that kind of imagery in your head. It could see kind of a little more pliable, I think.
So we got the North Korean commander's film noir scene where he's exploring the restricted Martian basement and he hears some low voices talking. Chaos ensues.
Chaos doesn't ensue. And then he gets hit in the head by Lee. And they kind of, I don't know, as I'm thinking about it, is Lee, I thought the North Koreans kept to themselves. Or they just have access to any place in the base because they just come and go as they please?
Well, I think they've probably got access to the common areas, and clearly there's some kind of fiddly thing on this control panel. So I'm guessing that he's like, yeah, they don't have access to this area either. So he just exploits whatever they're doing. But I thought what I love about this is how it just got out of hand so quickly. It goes from like him just probably, you know, listening to him being discovered by, I guess Lee followed him down there because he's trying to protect his access to his wife.
Right.
And it just like, you know, Ron Burgundy says, wow, that escalated quickly. Command Cho's dead. Lee tridented him.
Well, let me ask you this: speculate, is he dead, or is he just knocked out? And what happens next with that?
Like I said, they didn't have the spine snapping sound, so I can't say conclusively. But I do think that in Hollywood terms, holding someone's neck until they pass out means they're dead. That's not how it works in real life,
no.
But it is how it works in Hollywood. So I'm guessing he's dead. I don't know what the. The only reason, I guess, to keep Cho alive is to, I guess, add an extra complication because they have to have this guy hostage while they're trying to steal the asteroid. But him being dead is a pretty big complication.
Yeah, he's being dead is a complication, but it's easier to deal with. You just throw him out the airlock or something.
True, but now you got the whole North Korean wing wondering where the hell their commander's going. And, you know, they're going to... It's more pressure and scrutiny that this pirate operation doesn't need, right?
Absolutely. That's why I'm leaning towards he's alive. Because then you got to keep him on ice while you're trying to do all the
more interesting, yeah. And you've got this guy's kind of trying, because that's the other thing, is like keeping a human being captive in like an ad hoc way is surprisingly difficult. We're very smart monkeys. We got opposable thumbs. We can undo knots.
I was in trouble with it. I'm kidding.
we can appeal to our fellow monkeys for the sympathy, and that kind of works. There's a lot of psychology. It's hard. You have to have big concrete and steel facilities to store human beings in any kind of reliable way, and they still escape.
Really good broadband.
You know? True.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't need to. If you need me to stay put, just give me some video games, order me some pizza. I'll chill out for 48 hours, no problem.
We'll keep Commander Ho on ice with some Battlestar Galactica Blu-rays and some pizza.
Danny can start him on MASH and Star Trek.
I'm saying, man. Well, MASH is MASH will do it. All right, well, no, they wouldn't want to use MASH because that's the Korean War.
Yeah, but it's kind of sympathetic. Like, I guess if he watched the full thing, he might be. But yeah, you're probably wrong. They're North Koreans. That'd be some Imperial propaganda.
Yeah, he'd just inflame him more. You know, he'll go want to get that Hawkeye guy.
Or So we're in the we're in the final stretch here, and Sergey retires to his motel room with some takeout McDonald's, and he's going to have a virtual date with Margot, who's retiring to her hotel room to enjoy
for a ketchup sandwich.
Oh my God! I'm glad you noticed the amount of ketchup. She's like, well, they gave me a mini bottle, so I guess I can use it all. Holy hell!
Like you guys were saying last episode, that those hamburgers look nasty. You know, and I don't know that much ketchup's going to fix it. It may probably make it worse, you know?
Yeah, I think that I understand Margot, because of all she's had is like, you know, pierogi and borscht for 8 years, then any hamburger is going to taste like heaven. But Sergey, what the hell's your excuse? You've been living in Iowa, you know?
They have beef
and corn
there.
Capital of the world. Exactly. Lots of it.
Actually, Iowa is a top export is soybeans. It's not corn. But
you know what? That actually tracks. I'm from Indiana, and they all talk about the corn, but in my hometown, it was beans, lots of beans.
But here's the thing, though. Getting a little nitpicky here, but you don't put ketchup on a Big Mac, right? Fast food burgers are single autonomous units. You just eat them as is.
Yes, they're a unit of food. They don't they don't need embellishing. They don't need implements. They're like almost, especially like Big Macs are a little messier, but like. The whole charm of a McDonald's sandwich, like their hamburgers, is they're sealed. You essentially just pull it out, eat it in the car, and they're going to get shit all over you.
Like a
burrito of hamburgers.
I'm going to say, as a Californian, I'd really hate if my last meal was a Big Mac. It had to be In-N-Out Burger. You know what I mean? Like I'll get shot in the head by a Soviet operative if I can have some In-N-Out Burger right before. But he never got to eat the burger either. Before it takes a bite, you know, bullet to the head.
You fucking West Coast people with your in and outs. I'm so jealous. I'd put up with the earthquakes just to get in and out because it's every
come
time
on
I go.
Sometime, man. Every we'll go time I go, out.
I do. Every time I was delighted. I was in Salt Lake City this year for travel. I was delighted that they had an in and out next to the airport. I'm like, oh my God, this is an unexpected. The Mormons are doing something right. They got in and out.
A lot of people in Texas say Whataburger is the case, but no, it's in and out.
No,
sorry,
they're wrong. No, yeah, they Whataburger wrong. Is just bullshit. The White Castle, or is that Crystal Burger? I get confused, but I've had both Crystal and Whataburger. It is no, I'm not jealous of any. I'm only the only fast food chain I'm jealous of not having in the Midwest is In-N-Out.
See, we differ on Star Trek, but we agree on In-N-Out.
There you go.
We brought it back, Aaron. But on a serious note about this, I was a little. This actually is a little nitpicky, I think, but it does kind of bother me. The angle of the bullet in Sergey's head is like right on his temple, right? Mm-hmm. So where did this guy come from? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the Sopranos, when they blow Tony's head off, the dude's being from behind. So we get that, right?
Uh-huh,
but this is right on the side. So did he not have peripheral vision? I mean, a Big Mac is good. It's not that good.
The only thing I can think of is they got the Duke Ellington blaring, because that's the other thing. How the hell
that was Margo. That wasn't him. He was.
I thought they were both listening. I thought that was the whole idea, that they're having like a virtual date. So, but if this goes triple what I'm about to say, even with Duke, like I can barely. This is not a hotel room that opens up into a quiet a hallway. This is a motel.
Right.
It opens up into the fucking outdoors. How the hell Sergey wasn't aware of someone opening up his door, unless the guy was in the bathroom? Maybe the guy had gotten there. So, okay, he's there first, and he comes up from behind and takes the pistol. I don't know. I guess I can. It's certainly not the biggest pill I've had to swallow in the season.
No. It just kind of bothered me when I was watching again. Yeah.
Do you think that they were foreshadowing his brains getting blown out by all the ketchup that Margot is using? Is that the reason she used all that ketchup? Because it mirrored the amount of brain material that got splattered over that lamp?
I mean, that's a pretty nasty reason. That's kind of nasty. I don't know if I want to think about it, but maybe. A thought occurred to me, too. Like, you know, but... Because my blood's basically ketchup, so I mean, it makes sense, right?
they got the oranges, like in Godfather. Godfather's got the oranges. They got their mini Heinz ketchup bottles.
Oh my God, that was such an absurd amount of ketchup on that burger. Anyway.
My takeaway is, aside from ketchup, is this is what happens when you stay at a Days Inn, man. Like, come on. The Hamptons just down the road. Yeah, it's $100 more, Sergey, but what? You're about to run to Brazil with your dream woman, you know? What the heck?
I never stay at motels for this various reason. Like, I've seen too many movies where bad stuff happens in motels. I'm always like, you know, a hotel with a lobby and like, you know, doors and hallways and whatnot.
I almost feel like it's like, what am I, because like I kind of wanted to belabor the point, but like honestly, because I imagine people like, well, how did they try? It's like, I have no questions. Like, this was, they have been so sloppy and so careless that this actually just made perfect sense.
You know? I actually went back and looked at this as Margo's KGB handler because I thought maybe it was kind of similar. It wasn't, but yeah, they've been so messy. You know, like how, I don't know. It makes you wonder what's going to happen to Margo. I mean, do you think she gets out of the season alive, or do you think KGB takes her out?
The thing is, does this show have the balls to completely clean out the old guard? Because or maybe they're setting things up with Ed where he will be the old man. He will be the survivor. He will be the 80-year-old geriatric guy that is dying in a nursing home shit. Maybe, but like, if they do kill Danny and Margo, who's left? Like, I mean, Elaida, I guess, but she was just a little, like, she was just a seed to be planted, to be harvested in season two. Like, it seems crazy to clean out everybody. Like, you have no one from season one that had a big part left in the series if you kill all of them. So it's like, and also, what would the point of Margo dying? Because, like, to me, the point of Margo is being forced to deal with her existence. But that's, you know, that's like a narrative point. It's not like a factual one.
I was going to say, what are their contract? You know, what are their contract information? Like who's up again?
True. It's going into year five. Maybe it's going to be expensive to sign Rin Schmidt and Kinnaman and Chris Marshall.
The asteroid's going to slam into Happy Valley. It's going to take them all out.
God.
And then peace flies maybe off Margo.
I don't think they kill all three. I think you can kill Danny or Ed or Margo, and Margo thematically probably makes the most sense. But my heart says I hope Danielle makes it out.
My storyteller training tells me that it's going to be Danny and Ed and Margo to make it out. But here's to your point though. Something, man, it's like this is supposed to be a seventh season show, right? So we're on season five next. They do about 10 years each season. How much longer does Ed have anyway?
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. I know me and Jim have joked about like maybe he'll have a medical advance and that he can be like, you know, in the first episode of TNG that they had what's heavily implied to be Admiral McCoy. Yeah. And he's like 145 years old and he looks like a Ferengi and he's busting Data's chops and talking about being afraid of the teleporter. I could almost see a guy like Ed living on Mars with advanced medical, but like, yeah, I mean, with seven seasons, they're going to have to rip off the Band-Aid. But I'm just saying, like, who carries forward the torch next year? Because I don't give a shit. I don't give a shit about Miles. I like Elaida. That's a pillar you can build on. I like Will. Yeah. I liked Will, the gay astronaut from last season, but he's kind of been very background. They haven't really developed him. Kelly, Dev, is that what we're going to build the new show around?
I can see Dev. I can see, it's by extension Kelly. Elaida. Is it Elaida? Am I pronouncing her name wrong? Elaida?
I think it's Elaida,
yeah. I'm terrible with names. But Elaida, same. I can see that too. She kind of moves into the Margo, you know, space position that she occupied in a couple seasons.
They've been positioning her for that for a while, yeah.
Yeah. So I could see that. I mean, time marches
on. There's no astronauts. We have no astronaut. Like Sam Massey, like she's kind of been a nothing character too. So like I do have concerns of where, like as much as I'm invested in the story of like general, like how humanity gets out of into the 21st century, I don't see where, because this show is like its real gift is like they had these really strong characters and you were there from the beginning with them. And I've been worried all season long. It's like, where are the new characters that they're bringing along? And I can see like there was a kind of a Russian Elaida that, you remember her, the one that was upset that her mentor got killed by the KGB. Maybe they could make something out of her. They've got, like I said, Will. But like I don't really see the astronauts. But maybe that's the point, is like NASA and having astronauts and cosmonauts will be a lot less important. You know, they're going to become the truck drivers of the
future. It's probably going to be less, because you think about the earlier couple of seasons, you got those steely-eyed missile men and whatnot. Well, it's not about that anymore. Yep. It's about the commercialization of space and how, you know, if we want to go forward, it's going to be about you know, it's gonna be taking our own bullshit with us. You know, I think you said the capitalist systems and whatnot, you know, people on the top, people on the bottom, how are we gonna work this out? And that's where the drama is gonna come from. Like, how do we deal with these same problems on Earth that now we have in space? Or rather, the problems we had on Earth are now in space. How do we deal with this? And it's almost like the things we're gonna be doing in the subsequent seasons are gonna be like a backdrop. Like,
yeah.
This season's been a lot about, like, you know, classes and not class warfare, but you know what I mean? But it's also it takes place on Mars, and that's kind of the backdrop. And the asteroids kind of become important the last few episodes, whereas in the middle of the season, it was all about the classes and strikes and who was who and who does what and who's responsible for what. So, like, next season, I bet it's probably going to be about asteroid mining, because that's the next logical step in our space program. So we'll have the same kind of thing, you know? We have problems on Earth. There are not going to be problems in space. How do we deal with them? Same way. Poorly, usually. And that's where I see it going.
We'll be back right after this spacewalk. Strap in, we're diving into more For All Mankind. All right, any other observations of the episode? Or are we ready to get to some feedback?
I said all my piece on it, I think.
All right. Well, feedback, you can send it in to FAM, that stands for All Mankind, FAM@baldmove.com. Of course, if you're looking for what else we're covering, we got a whole bunch of stuff. True Detective, I know, is the only thing I know that we're going to be doing in January, but I know the Rick and Michonne spinoff, The Walking Dead, we're excited about in February. There's the Three-Body Problem, I think, in March. We're considering maybe doing Shogun. There's a lot of irons in the fire, but like I said, we normally spend the first week or two of the new year figuring out what our new year is going to be, and Jim got COVID, so we're but my point is, if you want to find out, if you want to know, you should follow us on social medias. We're at Bald Move everywhere except for TikTok. We're at Baldest Move there. Carl is up first. Says, in episode 6, when Margot tried to defend herself for defecting, Alayda responded by talking about all the people who were at their post during the bombing. And it was a great scene. You guys interpreted this as Alayda pointing out how Margot walked off when other people stuck with it. I felt like Alayda was more directly putting their deaths on Margot. Is it possible that Alayda thinks the Russians somehow planned the bombing so they could disappear Margot without questions? And if so, is she right? Was Russia behind the bombing, or at least aware of it? During all the Jimmy stuff last season, I only saw domestic terrorists on screen, but some of the things I read about the Cold War, CIA, and KGB involvement in domestic organizations make it seem plausible. Some of the recently declassified stuff between Lee Harvey Oswald's various groups, for example, show a very fuzzy line between dissidents and government agencies. Without the bombing, I don't understand the plan for defection. If Margot had just disappeared out of the Johnson Space Center in the middle of the Martian baby crisis, it would have presumably been international news. Having Margaret Reynolds appear in a bakery in Moscow a few weeks later couldn't have worked, right? So I got a surprising amount of email over the break of people making, there's like four or five people making the same point. Was Johnson Space Center a Russian plot, or did they know about the plot and use it as cover to abduct Margot? Do you have any gut feelings about that, B. Michael?
I think that's probably the latter, what you're saying. I think if anything, if they were aware of it, they didn't care. You know, I like the plot about what they're saying about domestic terrorists and whatnot, because we do have domestic terrorists in America. They do bomb things, especially government buildings. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that the USSR was involved in that particular plot, because, you know, it was a bunch of angry, like, young adults, but I think if they knew anything about it, they probably didn't care to stop it. And, you know, I don't know, as it used for cover for Margot, you know, people disappear all the time. So
that's, yeah, right. That, because so here's the, like, my take on this is the same with every kind of broad conspiracy theory, is like, where's the evidence? Like,
yeah.
You know, do you think the CIA faked some big explosion in Russia when they got Sergei, or did they just get him out? And Russia's like, fuck, where'd Sergei go? Like, I think it's the latter. But if you're a, you know, Russian watching For All Mankind and want to think, I bet CIA did this or that, I think, I don't know. Like, because, it definitely is plausible that it could happen. But I feel like even in real life, like, you can pull off a conspiracy in the short term But over a 10-year period of time, no fucking shot does not all the dirty laundry eventually trickle out and come out. Like, So I would have to see more evidence. I think it's more plausible the Russians had information about the bombing and they maybe scheduled it to take advantage. But, like, man, the timing. Did they know? Because this was a cell phone bomb that the guy triggered, like, manually. They has some really fucking tight timing if it was intentional. You know what I mean? And timing out of their control, by the way.
Yeah. So I don't think the Russians were involved. I think if anything, if the most they probably was they knew about and just didn't figure they could use it to their advantage.
All right. Next up is Eric, who's a resident NASA guy. He says, I know a little something about the DART mission because I was at the launch. See attached photo. This stud took a picture of himself in front of his fucking rocket. He says, there's no fucking way we would intentionally redirect a potentially hazardous object towards Earth. Even with DART, we carefully selected the target asteroid to ensure there's absolutely no risk to Earth by running the redirection test. In addition, the size of Goldilocks asteroid is more than 6 times the diameter of Dimorphos, the one DART intercepted. Plus, since it's metal rich, it's likely orders of magnitude more massive than Dimorphos. As such, a kinetic impactor like DART is not a viable option. A nuclear proximity detonation to deflect the asteroid is probably the only credible way to change its trajectory. That technique has not only never been tested, but introduces so much uncertainty that it'd be impossible to predict with any precision where it would go. These redirection techniques have been developed to push an object away from Earth, so the uncertainty of how much it moves is not so much of an issue as it would be if you wanted to direct it to a specific location. For those interested in learning more about Trojan asteroids, follow the NASA Lucy mission, which just did a flyby of the main belt asteroid on its way out to the Trojans. And one last, by the way, item, the James Webb telescope does have the capacity to image bright objects in our solar system using its near-infrared camera. It's already imaged Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And here's the NASA blog post on the Jupiter images. So that last is me and Jim question whether... Because they have the analog of the James Webb telescope detecting the asteroid in the first place. Like, why? That's not what it's designed for. But apparently, it can do a bang up job of that too.
It's got pictures of Uranus, so it can do anything.
Obviously, I think there's been some fast and loose science facts this season, and obviously they're not doing a kinetic interceptor, they're doing a giant starship with ion drives to do this thing. So, but the fact that no one is mentioned, like, I just need some NASA engineer being like, we got to make damn sure we're careful with these calculations because, you know, an orbit of Earth could easily be an impact with Earth. Because, like, it's almost like they don't even think about it. And that's what's wild to me.
Yeah. While you're reading the letter, it says picture in my mind of, like, everything going wrong and the asteroid hitting Earth through its extinction level event. And all they have now is a Mars colony. And that's the show from now on.
Dude.
I mean,
that would be interesting.
That would be a baller move on behalf of Mr. Moore. It's terminated all of humanity except what's on Mars.
I actually looked it up early on, and I think this asteroid would not exactly be a planet killer. It's more of like what you would call a continent killer. You know, like it would like if it landed in North America, it would devastate the entire. But like the other side of the Earth would be quote unquote, you know, after 6 months of nuclear winter or so, be fine. It would be interesting to have like a very weakened Earth and a Mars colony, and now suddenly they're on even, because that's like, you guys might be onto something, because the whole point of this show is two sides in a conflict, unless they're at rough parity, things stagnate and decline. And, you know, you have to have crisis situations to give humanity, show humanity at their best. So maybe whacking Earth, taking out half its population and severely weakening it and putting it on par with Mars is an interesting way for the story to go forward.
They can't do that. They're not doing that. But
you don't think so? They're not? Okay.
I mean, that's...
I'm skeptical.
That's pretty ballsy.
Also the guy... I think I'm one of the first guys that said, hey, what if? So maybe I'm a little bit more sympathetic to it.
That'd be hilarious, though. Like the end of episode 10 is like, you know, Earth's devastated and Dev's been in his office like, oops, maybe we shouldn't have done that.
Andy said, so a latest initial proposed investing $2 trillion today for $20 trillion in 40 years is idiotic. It corresponds to about a 6% rate of return for something massively risky and complex. That's worse than just investing in a stock market index fund. Maybe she's an engineer that doesn't know shit about investing, but I mean, you'd hope Dev would know better. I guess it's a moot point since they're tugging the asteroid to Earth, but still, so dumb. I can see why Helios Board was not a fan of Dev. So look, I know even less about economics than I do rocket science, but I wonder if you like account for inflation and the fact that this is a raw material that's extremely rare on Earth, and having it be abundant would open up it's not like stock market where it's like you got a little bit of money and then you've got more money in the future. This is like discovering, you know, I don't know. I don't know economics enough to even make the analogy, but it's like, is it, when you talk about the inflation and we talk about the raw material and the fact that it would open up technology that we don't have access to, is that still true? I don't know.
I would think partially, because I was trying to figure this out too, because, like, you know, I don't really have a background in economics. I know a little bit enough to get me into fights on the internet, but, like, wouldn't demand, when you have all sorts of new raw material come in, demand would, or supply would be so great that the prices would drop, which means you would have even less of a return on your investment because now it's common, right? Iridium is expensive and valuable because it's rare. But if it's not rare anymore, well, how valuable is it? You see what I'm saying?
But what industry opens up if you have cheap iridium? Because right now you only use it on things that's like, oh my God, you gotta, you know, it's like I mentioned last episode, it's the reason that we have cars that can go 100,000 miles between tune-ups is because they now coat the tips of the spark plugs with iridium so they don't, you know, get blasted apart by electric discharge. So
that's true.
It's hard. It's like, you know, space costs a lot of money, but you get Tang and Velcro out of it. And where would we be without, you know, it's like, I don't know how to make those arguments, but I thought the show was pretty realistic about Earth being like, yeah, 40 trillion and 40 or 10 trillion in 40 years. Fuck that.
Yeah, that was realistic.
Yeah. Well, Maurice. Oh yeah. I'm sorry. Did you have something else?
I was going to say Hollywood writers. I mean, I love them. I know a bunch of them. They don't know anything about finance and economics either. That's why they're Hollywood writers and not work in the stock market. You know,
right.
No offense to my boys out there, but, you know. But, yeah, you're right. The return on the investment argument is actually correct from what I understand.
Maurice, regarding crossing the picket line, says, in regards to the strike, I think given the magnitude of what they're doing and what and where they are, I think it's criminal. I'm all for workers' rights, but, we're talking about an asteroid that could potentially make or break humanity. This is not widget building manufacturing plant in the middle of nowhere, name a state. Let's take that first, because I have a take. What's your take, B?
On whether or not whether it's appropriate for them to be striking?
Yes.
Are they right
to stand in the way of 6 billion people progressing?
What other leverage do they have? The whole point of a strike is to create as much pain as possible on the party you're trying to negotiate with so that they negotiate more favorable terms to you. That's what we saw the writers and actors strike out in Hollywood here earlier this year, right?
Yeah.
These guys have no leverage, really none. They're on a planet that's far away from home, and they really have no control over what they're doing. So the best time to strike is when they have that kind of leverage with the asteroid program happening. So I would get parties to the table, get them to make deals, and get things going, because it's imperative for this thing to happen. So management has to cooperate on some degree.
Yeah, I like the instance like this, turn the telescope or the microscope in the other direction and be like, what right does Helios and Russia and America have to stiff these workers when there's so much advancement to be made? Like, you could pay these guys 10 times what they're making now and they would all be over the moon. You could probably just double their salary, quadruple their salary. They would be over the moon and instantly go gleefully to work, even though they're still being ripped off.
Yeah.
Because if they kept the asteroid for themselves, they're talking about a billion more times than they're going to be making over their lifetimes, right? So they're still getting fucked, but they would be happy to do it. So why don't they just do that? Why do they send astronauts crawling through tunnels to set themselves on fire, rather than pay these 500 workers another couple hundred thousand dollars? That's the morality that I see. But I understand not everyone sees it that way, which is why we have all the problems we do. But, like, I just don't understand how you can't just turn who's really got the power, you know? It'd be one thing if they're asking for, I think that's something that Dev made. Like, it'd be one thing if they're asking for something impossible. Like, they wanted unicorns and we're going to blow up the world unless we get unicorns.
Right.
They're wanting more money and better benefits. So give it to them.
And then labor Earth can progress. Yeah. So, no, I agree with you. You and I are simpatico on this front.
Yeah. Maurice also wants to know if the show's being renewed. I want to see where this all goes. I think I would be shocked if Apple cans this. Because they do have a commitment to, especially it seems like their science fiction stuff, but it's, I haven't heard any confirmations and we probably won't get one until after the season. So let's just cross our fingers and hope.
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's a five, maybe Ronald Moore's done. He's going to destroy the Earth, put everyone on Mars and that's it. Wipe his hands clean.
Fred K says, what would be easier than mining the asteroid in Earth orbit what would be easier than mining the asteroid in Earth orbit or in Mars orbit? Crashing into Mars and mining into the ground. That would give the image of the guy in a spacesuit with a pickaxe more relevance, too. So this is, you already mentioned this. This is another popular theory that we'll be dealing with in feedback. The idea that you're going to crash the asteroid into Mars, that this is the ultimate cynical play by Dev, that he's going to crash it into Mars and reap all the profits. Fuck your orbital mining. Because that's the thing. It's unclear to me how Mars would exploit the asteroid without Earth's help. And
they would have to create an entirely different infrastructure. They'd have to put like a space elevator up there. They'd have to, and that's a problem. That's why it's so expensive. That's why the government's balked at this, because in order to use this asteroid, they had to create entirely new ships, new everything to kind of for it to happen. So it's easier to crash it into the surface and mine it that way.
I agree. He also says, also what happened to Ed's mustache glue in this episode. Maybe just he had more close-ups or he was crying and that we could, but like, yeah, I mean, Ed's makeup has been kind of touch and go this whole season. Alex from San Diego had similar thoughts to Fred. He says, I feel this sudden heel turn by Dev regarding the stealing the asteroid is masking his true plan. I think he's done the calculations and added more time to the burn that would be needed. I think he intends to crash it into Mars to prevent any remote chance that M7 gets their hands on it. Where, you might ask? Into the crater, where Kelly's doing her research. Not only would the crater localize the iridium, but the crater rim could serve as a wide base of operations as there is water at the site. The writers have set this up perfectly, establishing the crater is more than 6,000 kilometers from Happy Valley. Next week, we get the heist with the impact, and the finale shows Kelly and her team trying to escape the fallout.
It's interesting, too.
Holy shit. That would be dark from Kelly's perspective.
I was just going to say, because they might have discovered life, and then Dev exterminates life.
Just to enrich himself? Yeah. Because you're talking about the technology, like, it might take Mars 200 years to realize the asteroid gain without any help from Earth. And they'd have to keep, the Marines from coming this whole time. Whereas if you crash into the ground, fuck you, it's Mars now. No one's getting it out now. So I'm very nervous that this is exactly what's going to happen. Now,
actually, yeah.
I don't know if the space geology works out that way. If you crash an asteroid into a 20-mile crater, does it contain it? Does the water get blasted out? I mean, I honestly don't know. And at this point, I don't know the showrunners know or care either. So I'm very nervous that this might actually be what... Because I do think Dev's not being fully honest with all of his compatriots here.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, sorry, go on. We'll move on. That's just an interesting idea.
Let's see. A Wookiee says, listening to your coverage of episode 8, you mentioned the writers and actors strike and how odd it was to have the strike break so easily in your show and being done so sloppily. Being as this airing now, doesn't that mean that this was all written and filmed prior to the actors and writers strike?
Yes.
Yo, for sure. And I don't think I was saying that, like, isn't it funny that they're writing this as they're striking? It's more of like, isn't it ironic how they're writing about how the workers get fucked over by management and have no recourse and they get ran stupid and there's no solidarity when in just months they would be participating in one of the largest labor strikes in Hollywood and essentially break the studios. It's just like, it's like a Alanis Morissette type of irony.
God, I grew up in the 90s. I have no idea what irony actually means anymore. Is it ironic?
I think we've worn it out. I think I said this 10 years ago on a Bold Move podcast. I think we're ready for a sincerity age. Like, I think we need to just fuck all this irony and ironic detachment and just be sincere. Just be Mr. Rogers in 21st century, okay?
I think that already happened to the millennials, because the Gen Zers are really detached and weird now.
Yeah, but they haven't gotten old yet, so we'll see.
If Dev slams the asteroid in America, they're not going to get old.
That's true. He's shooting for the Korolev crater, and he hits Texas.
I hope.
Tommy O says, I wonder if you could help me understand a few things about the asteroid planet's cost. Well, we've established that we're economic geniuses, so we'll see if we can help out, Tommy. It's stated they would need $1 trillion to mine the asteroid at Mars and be a decade before the nation states recover their cost. Obviously, it doesn't cost $1 trillion to capture it, so even if the nation states didn't want to pony up for the mining rights, wouldn't they still have wanted to capture it into Mars orbit instead of deciding it would be better to let it escape? At least then they could always fund mining in the future. Let's say Dev, Ed, and Sam pull this off and safely have the asteroid orbiting Mars. Couldn't Earth just reaccelerate it to leave orbit and send it back towards Earth? So there's two things here. I think the idea that Earth would spend $1 trillion to park the asteroid on Mars, maybe sort of kind of doing something in the future, does not, I don't think the way they've laid out how the nation states look at that, that's the plan with less sure of a payoff, right?
Yeah, I think so too.
And then as far as, like, I do think you're on to something about parking it in the Mars orbit. They could always just unpark it, but they're also implying that this is kind of a unique, kind of like the Voyager mission, the grand tour of the solar system that they took in the 80s. That was a once in a generation opportunity to do that, because the Delta V required to visit all those planets without the complicated slingshot systems that they used to actually out accelerate the first Voyager program. Those alignment of planets wasn't going to happen for another 100 years or so. So that is a space thing that every once in a while, if you squint and do the calculations, you can cheat the shit out of that Delta V if you have enough gravity slingshots. But those planets are not, you know, it's like a video game. It's not like you can just go to Mars and slingshot to Jupiter every single time. And I think they have successfully convinced me that that's this case, that this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. They get a $20 trillion windfall for Earth. And if they even wait 6 months, it won't be available anymore. So I think that's what you're supposed to understand, that, like, okay, they got in Mars orbit, but who the hell's got the Delta V to get that into a trans Earth trajectory, you know, in the next decades? Like, you know, their fusion things just aren't going to do it. So does that track with you, B?
Yeah, I think a little bit, but one thing it does kind of put a little bit of a burr in my saddle about this is that, what is the end game here, right? Like, I think I can buy what you're saying, that if they get into our Mars atmosphere, Earth is just going to accept it because probably they're moving it again is expensive and maybe not be able to have technical reasons. But I mean, what do they do then? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I just don't see, like, everyone just kind of like, Dev, you got us now with guess we'll have to mine the asteroid on Mars. Like, I don't know. This might be too big of a big answer for this question, but yeah, I probably, going to your point, I think it probably can. I buy that this is a once in a generation chance to get this to happen, and that's okay.
Yeah, and like I said, they could. I mean, if it is parked in Mars orbit, that's the worry. It's like, why don't you just send in the Marines? You know, get the Space Force spun up 20 years early, send them out there and take. Because, like, what the hell is Mars going to do against the combined might of Earth? You know, that's see the early goings of the Expanse. The prequel novels of the Expanse, and see how that works out.
And I was going to say, and that kind of, like, I think might lead some credence to the idea that this thing crashes, right? Because from a narrative perspective, creating, spinning all that out creates a lot of problems, where crashing it on Mars and mining it that way, it's neat and simple to go on to the next season.
No, you're definitely onto something. That's why I'm like, man, I'm starting to really warm up to, because that's the other thing, is that that is the appropriate, that's the kind of, like, mind-blowing shit that, like, For All Mankind tries to, like, you think it's going to be the one thing, and the finale is always, like, the other. So that would definitely be, because I until people started emailing, that was not on my radar. I was thinking accidental impact hypothesis. I wasn't thinking, you know, calculated impact hypothesis. So that's it for this week's show. For All Mankind, that's FAM. FAM at baldmove.com if you want to send in feedback for next week. Again, follow us on all our social medias at baldmove. B. Michael, again, thank you so much for substituting for Jim. Do you got anything you want to shout out in terms of, I definitely will link your socials and anything else you want in show notes, but if you I think you said that in typical LA fashion, you're between projects right now.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. That's what they say out here. I'm between projects. So, so nothing really to shout out. I'm just like happy to be here. Like I said, I think the only real thing qualified me to be on this podcast, you and I argued about Die Hard being a Christmas movie on Twitter. So,
true. But you also you've done a lot of like NFL podcasting.
Yeah, I did that. I'm being funny. Yeah. So.
Yeah. He's got a great voice. You got to get behind a microphone again.
Oh, thank you, sir. I'm recovering from a cold.
Oh, is that the husk? Performance enhancing disease is what you're doing.
Yeah, I'll be trying to get my Tom Waits voice happening now for the rest of the day. Like, oh no, A-Ron told me I had a great voice. I'm going to start screaming every morning to kind of get it like this again.
Yeah. You got to do 30 minutes of screaming into a pillow to get into the shape.
I'll just join an AC/DC cover band. Yeah, it's bad. It's bad.
Well, again, thanks, B. Appreciate it. Had a great time, and maybe we'll work together soon or hopefully again in the future. Yeah. All right, we'll see you next week on For All Mankind. Until then, I'm A-Ron.
I'm not.
Say goodbye, everybody.